Breakthroughs in cognitive science over the past 25 years have given rise to hope that a new era of brain-based teaching and learning may soon be upon us. Yet precious few advances have actually been made. Dan Willingham, a cognitive psychologist at the University of Virginia and author of the American Educator's Ask the Cognitive Scientist column, offers a bridge between the laboratory and the classroom in his volume, Why Don't Students Like School? A cognitive scientist answers questions about how the mind works and what it means for the classroom. In today's edition of the Education Next Book Club, we speak with Dan about his book, the responses he's seen in the field, and the indisputable cognitive principles that guide how humans learn. Dan, welcome to the Education Next Book Club.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm a big fan of your writing. I'm really excited to have you on the show, Dan. All right, let's start with a simple question. What motivated you to write this book?
I didn't think there was a book out there that was similar. I mean, I've felt that, and I've written about this elsewhere, that as you said in the introduction, we do know quite a lot about the mind. We've learned a lot in the last 30 years or so. But going directly from the laboratory to the classroom is tricky. There are real problems, and as any teacher can appreciate, the fact that something works in the laboratory doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work in the classroom. And so the idea behind the book is that there are certain fundamental principles that are so important, you're going to see them in action in the classroom, no matter basically any place you've got humans learning, you're going to see these principles in action. And so it doesn't matter what sort of classroom you're in, and across a diversity of kids, these principles are pretty much always going to be true. And so I thought that was an interesting way to sort of frame how cognitive psychology might contribute to education.
But why is it that it's so hard to translate from the laboratory to the classroom?
The big reason is that when you are in the laboratory, you're a scientist trying to study how the mind works. Your goal is to isolate cognitive processes and to study one thing at a time in order to simplify. Mm. So, for example, you might want to study processes of attention, or you might want to study processes of memory. Well, if you're studying memory, you want attention out of the picture. You want motivation out of the picture. So, in other words, I just want to look at how memory works. I want to know that everybody is really in there trying. They're reasonably motivated. They're paying attention to me, the experimenter. So that I can study just memory and not see the results of my experiment clouded by motivational effects or something like that. Well, in the classroom, naturally, everything is free to vary simultaneously. So a finding from the laboratory that might be perfectly true and very reliable about learning or memory might turn out to kind of backfire in the classroom because whatever it is you're doing affects motivation as well and affects motivation in a bad way.
Okay, so you're saying that all these things are interrelated and it's really hard to isolate them in a way that might be helpful for teachers who have to deal with, you know, the totality of all these complex beings called kids.
Exactly. Well, let me give you a really example that's so simple it's kind of lame brain. But repetition is good for memory, right? Very obvious aspect of learning. So if you just took that and popped it into a classroom without really thinking about it, you'd say, okay, everybody, all kids sit down, you're all going to repeat this until you've mastered it. Well, repetition is really good for memory, but it may not be so good for motivation, right? You do the same thing over and over again. That's a good way to get kids not to like school.
Okay, I got it. All right, so it can't be so simplistic. So I'm curious, what's the reaction to the book been?
In general, it's been quite good. Most teachers think that there's something interesting to say, that I've said something interesting in the book, and they appreciate the fact that I'm very concerned about classroom processes, and I'm not simply saying, okay, we know this from the laboratory gang, so go to it. So in general, response has been quite good.
Okay, now, so let's dive into some of the cognitive principles that you describe in your book. One insight, you say, quote, the mind is not designed for thinking. In fact, we tend to avoid thinking. What?
I know, this is always surprising, but I mean, when you think about it, you do spend an awful lot of time on autopilot, right? When you think about all the things that you do during the day, for which, if you wanted to, you could think of them as a bracing cognitive challenge, and you could try to solve this problem creatively. I mean, something as mundane as when I leave the office today, I'm going to walk out to my car and drive home. Well, why do I always take the same path when I walk out to my car? And why do I always walk? Isn't there a more interesting way that I could leave the building, right? I mean, maybe there wouldn't be, but why don't I think about that? Why don't I really engage with that as a problem? Well, the answer that, and I describe this in some detail in the book, is that thinking is very, very high cost, and it doesn't always pay off. It's high cost in that it is demanding and it's slow, it's time consuming, and it's also unreliable in terms of whether or not you're going to come up with, forget a good answer, you may not come up with any answer at all when you try to solve a novel problem. So typically, when we are confronted with a problem, our first resort is to go to memory. We look to see if we have solved this problem before or solved a similar problem before and ended up with a satisfactory answer. And if we have, we're very likely to to solve this problem the same way that we have in the past.
All right. So how is this relevant to teaching and learning then?
It's relevant to teaching and learning because teachers are confronted, I would argue, with this bias that the human mind is designed to save us from having to think. Typically, what we want to do is do what we've done in the past. Now, so it sounds very grim, right? Because it sounds like, you know, you got 25 kids in the classroom who are sitting there not wanting to think. But there is an opposing process, which is we do have a natural curiosity. We are interested in problem solving, but that's the important point. We're interested in solving problems because solving problems is pleasurable. We do get this this good feeling, this sort of snap of satisfaction when we've confronted a problem and then come up with a novel solution to it. So curiosity is a real thing, and you don't have to look far to see evidence for that. I mean, people spend their leisure time doing crossword puzzles or reading challenging mystery novels, that sort of thing. So the question is, what are the characteristics of curiosity? What are the types of problems where we will look at it and say, yeah, this is the kind of thing that I'm interested in. This is the kind of thing that I want to pursue. And this is not, I don't want to pretend that cognitive psychologists have completely unraveled this problem, because this is a difficult problem. But there is a contemporary theory which I think makes a lot of sense, and there are some data to support it. And that is that the level of difficulty of the problem is a crucial variable. So the idea is that we are curious about and will pursue a problem when we size it up as a problem where if I invest a little bit of energy in this problem and work to solve it, I'm likely to get that satisfying feeling. I'm likely to get that payoff of pleasurable feeling of having solved a problem. But if I look at a problem and I do this very rapid assessment of it, and I see that it's very, very easy, I know, well, I might be able to solve it, but it's not going to be fun. It's sort of the equivalent of, you know, an adult looking at a crossword puzzle that's designed for a first grader or something. You say, yeah, I'm sure I'm going to get all the answers right, but I'm not going to get any fun out of it. And then likewise, if I look at the crossword puzzle and someone like me who really is not all that good at them, and I see it's from, you know, the Sunday New York Times or something, I say, well, I'm going to be beating my head against the wall if I try this, right? But if it's sort of in the middle, if it's in this sweet spot of difficulty, that's where I get curious and I say, this is going to be worth it to me to invest some effort.
So you tell teachers that they need to make sure that their lessons are problems to be solved and that these problems are at the right level of difficulty. And if you don't do that, it's why, in the title of your book, Students Don't Like School.
Right. And of course, I don't want to pretend that, you know, there's lots of reasons people like and don't like school. So the title, when you asked before whether people like the book, the thing that people give me a hard time about is they say, well, I thought I was going to read a book about why kids don't like school. And you talk about that a little bit. But, and you know, I admit it's a little bit of a publishing stunt, the title. There are obviously lots of reasons people like school, don't like school, and so forth. But I would argue this is a significant factor in whether you're going to find a particular lesson medicine in particular pleasurable, is whether it's sort of hitting that sweet spot of difficulty or whether it's just blatantly too difficult for you and you're lost, or too easy for you and you're bored.
Okay, it's time to take a little break. We're talking here with Dan Willingham, the author of Why Don't Students Like School? We'll be back in a moment.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Okay, we're back with Dan Willingham, author of Why Students Don't Like School. A cognitive scientist answers questions about how the mind works and what it means for the classroom. Dan, thanks again for being with us today.
My pleasure.
All right, Dan, you know, when you're reading your book, it's so cheerful and it's so accessible, you sort of overlook the fact that you are going after some of the most widely held shibboleths of education and knocking them down. So let's talk about some of those right now. All right, first, you quote Einstein saying, "Imagination is more important than knowledge." Was he right?
I argue that he was not right on that particular point. And, you know, in the broader, what he actually said was a little more complicated than that. That is usually the quotation you see. And I tell a true story in there that I first encountered that quotation on a poster when I was in college in the room of a kid down the hall. But I think it captures something that a lot of people believe, which is this very process-oriented view towards education. Especially today, I mean, the sort of most extreme version that you hear of it today is, what is the point of learning all these facts when Google is at our fingertips? And what I argue in this chapter is that knowledge is really crucial to all of the cognitive processes that we most want our kids to have by the end of schooling. When we talk about creativity, when we talk about being a critical thinker, when we talk about problem solving, knowledge is really the mainspring of all of that.
All right, so let me get this straight. So you're not just saying that knowledge is important for its own sake, you know, that we want all kids to know certain things about history. What you're saying is that you can't get to these other things we all agree on, like critical thinking, without knowledge.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not just, you know, kids should know this because you're an educated person. You know, if you want to be an education, then educated person, then you should know these things. That's not what the argument is at all. That's a whole separate issue. This is really about, what does it take to be a critical thinker in science? What does it take to be someone who can really evaluate literature the way that we hope a high school graduate would be able to?
And then you explain that especially when kids are reading material, this comes into play, because you say writers leave things out.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not only writers, it's speakers as well, right? This is something that becomes really obvious once you think about it, but it's not something that most people appreciate. You're constantly sizing up your audience. And for the moment, let's just talk about speaking because it's easiest to think about there, but the exact same thing is true in writing as well. You're constantly sizing up your audience to evaluate what they know and what you can therefore safely leave out. The reason being that communication would be really slow, sort of tortuously slow, if you didn't do that. So, for example, suppose you walk up to me and I'm eating my lunch and you said, "Hey, what you got there?" What would be an appropriate answer? Well, to you, an adult, I'm likely to say, "Oh, it's ham and cheddar on rye," right? And that would be an appropriate response. But imagine if I said to you, "It's a sandwich," right? That'd be weird. But to a two-year-old, that would be a perfectly appropriate response, right? So why don't I say it's a sandwich to an adult? Because I assume that safely that an adult can see that I'm eating a sandwich, right? They already have this knowledge. So language has this characteristic all the time. I think of the example I use in the book is you could say to somebody, "I just got a puppy. My landlord is pretty upset," right? And so that seems like a perfectly natural thing to say, but obviously I am assuming that whoever is hearing that, those couple of sentences, knows something about puppies, namely that they're kind of destructive, and knows some stuff about landlords, namely they're kind of protective of their property. So the difficulty is when it's spoken language, there's not a big problem, because if I leave something out and you don't have the background knowledge to fill in the gaps, then no problem. You'll just say, wait, I don't know what you're talking about, right? But if you're reading something, you don't have the option of stopping the writer and querying him or her. Instead, you're probably going to give up on what you're reading.
All right, so you're a student, let's say you're a fifth grader and you're reading something, and it assumes that you have a background knowledge you don't have, and suddenly you can't comprehend what you're reading and you give up.
Exactly. And this is something that I point out. To me, the best example of this is reading a newspaper. When we talk about what is it that you would like kids, you know, high school graduates to be able to do, something that almost everybody can agree on is, well, I'd like them to be able to read a serious newspaper like the Washington Post. You pick up the Washington Post and read it, and you will see there are things that the writers and editors of the Post assume that their readership knows. So if your goal is for your student to be able to read the Washington Post, somewhere that student has got to pick up that information that the writers and editors of the Post assume that an educated reader will know.
You also describe an experiment about students reading about baseball.
Yes. Yeah, there have been a number of studies like that. And these results are really striking. In that particular experiment that I cite in the book, and as I say, there are a number of them, what they did was they divided kids, they were seventh and eighth graders, into two groups. One group had been identified by a reading test, standard reading test, as good readers. The other kids had been identified as struggling, poor readers. Then within each of those two groups, half of the kids were very knowledgeable about baseball. They were real baseball fans. The other kids, they basically, you know, they knew the rules of the game, but they weren't especially fans, right? So you have four groups of kids: good readers who know baseball, good readers who don't know much about baseball, and then likewise with not so good readers. Then they give everybody a passage to read that describes a half an inning of a baseball game, and they have the kids, their measure of whether or not the kids are getting it, reading comprehension, so they actually had a little model of a field and little players, and they act every now and then, they would say, okay, stop what you're reading and show me on this board with the little players what just happened. That was their measure of reading comprehension. And the really striking finding is that if you know something about the text, kids who had been identified as poor readers suddenly look like good readers, right? So poor readers, as defined by the reading test, who knew baseball, did much better in reading this passage than the supposedly good readers who didn't know anything about baseball.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, so the content knowledge, the background knowledge, was what mattered most.
Exactly. So when you're, I mean, and if you look at reading tests, Joe Torgerson has done some very nice analyses of reading tests. When you look at reading tests, up to about grade 3 or 4, mostly what they're testing is decoding. They're testing whether or not kids know how to turn written print into sound. But then after you get to grade 7, grade 8, most kids who are not, you know, really struggling, they're pretty good at that already. They're fairly fluent decoders. And so mostly what you're testing is comprehension. And comprehension is driven primarily by background knowledge.
Okay, let's look at another widely held assumption here, that teachers should try to make material relevant to students' lives. Is that true?
Well, I think that I think in a big way, no. What worries me is I occasionally see materials urging teachers to sort of make that the be all and end all of lessons. Obviously, you want to connect with kids. You want to make them feel that. Well, better put, rather than make them feel that it's relevant. I mean, you need to have some starting point for something that they can comprehend. But I think the idea that every lesson has to be relevant to the kids, that the child has to immediately see why this matters to me now, I think is a mistake. And there are two reasons for that. One is, I think there probably are certain things that teachers want kids to learn because the teacher can foresee that down the line, this is going to be very important. And the student is not in a position to appreciate that yet. So I think that I personally would not want my kids to have this sort of lit litmus test in their head that if the teacher can't show me that this is relevant to my life right now as a fourth grader, then in some sense, I don't really need to listen, right? I don't want to set up that expectation. The other thing is that I think there are other ways that that are more effective for driving interest besides personal relevance. I think there's some things that are just very difficult to make personally relevant to kids. I mean, geometry is, I think, is a great example. And I think there are other ways of driving interest.
And in fact, you say, I don't think content drives interest. And then you give an example from your own childhood. You want to tell us about that one?
I do. And I mean, well, I don't, and I actually don't remember from the book what example I gave, but oh God, yes, I do. Now
I remember.
Yeah, now I remember. That was right. That was the when I took sex ed, which was sort of amazing to me that the teacher could make sex ed boring when I was in the seventh grade. I was not alone. All my friends also were. We were just sort of looking at each other, dumbfounded that, you know, this topic we've been so looking forward to. But look, we've all been there, whether it's sex ed or something else. You know, you go to a talk, for example, or a documentary on a topic that you're genuinely interested in, and you're really surprised that, wow, this person actually made this topic kind of boring. Academics can really identify this because, you know, we go to professional conferences all the time. And, you know, I go to a cognitive psychology conference. I love cognitive psychology. I'm deeply, deeply interested in this stuff. Doesn't mean every talk is interesting by any means, right? I'm frequently bored at these conferences.
Right. And on the other hand, you might go to a documentary that you don't expect to like and find that you're fascinated by the topic.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think, you know, sure, I'm not claiming content is completely irrelevant to whether you're interested, but I really don't think it's decisive.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Dan Willingham, the author of Why Don't Students Like School? We'll be back in a moment.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Okay, we're back with Dan Willingham. Dan, you get at the issue of learning styles in the book. This has been a big issue in the last several decades. The idea of multiple intelligences is talked about a lot. A lot of the brain-based education stuff that's out there talks about this. So where do you come down on the idea of learning styles?
Yeah, so there's a lot of confusion here just on very basic definitional issues. So first thing to clarify, learning styles are not the same thing as multiple intelligences. These are very different ideas, although they're frequently confused. And they have a similar sort of feel because very often people invoke these ideas when they want to say something about ways in which kids are different. So let's start with multiple intelligences. Multiple intelligence is an ability theory. It's a way of talking about how kids differ in their abilities. And it emphasizes that some kids are good with language, some kids are good with math, some kids are good with physically and athletics, so forth. And so in one sense, there's nothing hugely surprising about this. And in the book, I refer to it as dangerously close to what a graduate advisor of mine used to call Bubby's psychology. And Bubby is Yiddish for grandmother. And so he said anytime he felt that it was really not very insightful theory, it was something your grandmother could have told you, he would dismiss it as Bubby's psychology. So the question is, how do you, you know, what do we know about the structure of human ability that goes beyond what your grandmother could have told you? And what I argue in the book is that the very basic outline of multiple intelligence theory is not really under dispute by most people. There are a few people who think, no, really, intelligence is just one thing. There aren't very many people like that. There aren't very many psychologists who believe that. Most of them think there is an important distinction to be made between people's ability in math and people's ability in language at a minimum. The most interesting ideas in education that have come out of multiple intelligences theory are ones that Howard Gardner, the main proponent of that theory, has long said are incorrect and are not implications of the theory. So one of the ideas that would be exciting if it were true, is that there's some interchangeability. So in other words, if you're weak in math, but you're strong in music, for example, you can leverage your ability in music to boost your mathematical ability. And Gardner has long argued that that's not true. I think he's 100% correct about that. In fact, a cornerstone of the theory is that the reason you're drawing a distinction between math and music, for example, is that they use different representations in the brain. They are different things, and therefore you wouldn't really expect that you would be able to use one as a substitute for the other. Now, learning style is a very different idea. So learning styles is not an abilities theory. It is a styles theory, right? So the analogy that I like is an athletic one. You could have two basketball players, for example, who are equivalent in their ability, but have very different styles on the court. One is a big risk taker, whereas the other has a very conservative style of game. So the idea here is that you've got a way that you prefer doing things, sort of different people might prefer different routes, but they're ending up in the same place. That idea has been around at least since the 1920s, and the real heyday for styles theories was post-World War II in the 50s, and no one has ever been able to come up with consistent evidence supporting the idea of learning styles. There was another sort of, so people basically sort of stopped doing research on this for a while. Then there was another burst of activity in the 70s when somebody had the idea, well, maybe this, okay, so maybe we don't really see much evidence for this in most people, but maybe kids who've been diagnosed with a learning disability, maybe there we're going to see evidence of styles. And again, it sort of came up empty. So it's very puzzling to research psychologists about why this idea is so widely accepted. I'll tell you that I haven't seen a recent survey, but I survey my class every year when I teach Introduction to Cognitive Psychology at the University of Virginia. It's about 350 kids, and usually about 90% of kids think that this theory is right, and specifically that there are visual learners, auditory learners, and kinesthetic learners. But again, no evidence to support.
Right, and in fact, you talk about how teachers can deal with students with different abilities. And this is a huge challenge for teachers today. We've got classrooms that are very diverse in terms of the abilities of kids coming in. One of the things that you say is, when you really look at it, kids' abilities don't differ as much as we think they do.
I think they. I think that's probably true. I think that in terms of, you know, when you look at something like raw memory ability, I think a lot of what we're looking at is difference in preparation. And I think kids do come into the classroom with huge diversity in preparation. And preparation can take a couple of different forms. One is what they already know coming into the class. And then another factor, which I think is hugely important, especially in early elementary, is self-control. And there's more and more data on that. The extent to which kids are able to resist distraction when they're asked to and stay on task, understand what's expected of them, and sort of have enough self-control to be able to do that. There, I think we do see a lot of diversity. And I think when teachers experience that, so I guess what I'm arguing against is that there are huge differences in intelligence, the way we would normally think of it, sort of raw processing horsepower. I think those differences exist. They're real. There's no point in pretending they're not. But I think they're generally overestimated. And I think a lot of what we're seeing and attributing to differences in intelligence are differences in preparation, which is basically what the kids already know when they come into the classroom, and then differences in self-control. And then once you get up to like grade 5 and 6, those differences in self-control turn into differences in motivation. Hmm. And kids who have not been successful, a lot of them have given up by that time.
But the optimistic note that you have is that even though there are these big differences in intelligence, you say that intelligence can be changed through sustained hard work.
Exactly. If you think that a lot of what we're calling intelligence is really familiarity with something, already knowing something about it, and a certain amount of fortitude in sticking with a task, even when you're frustrated, then yeah, intelligence is absolutely changeable.
Right. You tell parents, don't praise ability, you should praise effort.
That's right. And this is based on really fantastic work by Carol Dweck at Stanford, who's done a lot of this really important work in the last 20 years. And she's found that the way kids interpret praise is very, very important to their perception of self and also their perception of intelligence. So in other words, she's pointed out that if you tell kids, and not only pointed out, she has lots of data on this, if you tell kids you're really good at that, you must be really smart, they end up with this a view of intelligence as a fixed quality within themselves. The reason I'm good at this is that I'm a smart person. Well, what the consequence of that is that if you think that intelligence is fixed, that means it's not really under my control. And that means if I fail at something, then you might think that I'm not so smart. You might think I'm kind of stupid, and there's nothing I can do about that. Mm-hmm. And so the consequences that she sees is that people who have this fixed view of intelligence tend to go for, they're very concerned about appearances and looking smart, and so they try to find tasks that are really easy. Kids who have a malleable view of intelligence do the opposite. They don't think of failure as very threatening, right? If I fail at a task, that just means I haven't worked at it hard enough yet. That's not necessarily a big deal. And critically, it's under my control. If I want to be good at this task, because intelligence is malleable, all that means is I just need to work at it harder.
And that's an attitude you tend to see in Asian countries, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's much more an attitude that how well you do in school is under your own control. And if you're failing, it doesn't mean you're dumb. It just means you haven't worked hard enough yet.
Okay, Dan, this is fascinating stuff. I do hope that the teachers out there are taking this and learning from it. All right, let me ask you this. Are you hopeful that we're going to see teaching practice and teaching policy change to be more in line with what we're learning in the laboratory?
I hope so. Honestly, in some ways, I'm not that optimistic. One thing that, and this is actually the subject of the next book I'm writing, the title is When Should You Believe the Experts, with the experts in quotation marks. Because one thing that education is not done as a field is have any sort of way for what the field considers to be authoritative information to get through to practitioners. So if you think about it, if you're a physician, you're a family doctor, you go to medical school, you get trained in the latest techniques and so forth. Well, there's new research happening all the time. How in the world are you supposed to keep up? Well, a family physician is not really expected to keep up. They're not supposed to read the literature and sort of sift through it and figure out what's good research and what's crummy research. The medical profession has set up institutions to do that for practitioners. And so there are very reliable sources of information for doctors saying, okay, you know, now the data indicate there's a new way of treating, you know, strep throat or whatever it would be, where this used to be standard practice. That's no longer standard practice. Now we're doing this. There's nothing comparable at all in education, and practitioners, teachers, and administrators are completely left to their own devices to sort through what is quality research and what is not. I see that as a significant problem.
Okay, Dan. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I hope you'll come back next time when your next book comes out. Thanks again to Dan Willingham, the author of Why Don't Students Like School? A Cognitive Scientist Answers Questions About How the Mind Works and What It Means for the Classroom. You've been listening to the Education Next Book Club. Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.